Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters. I'm the head librarian. And before we begin, I'd just like to remind all of you to turn off your cell phone devices or anything that might interrupt the presentation. Thank you. I want to begin by thanking each and every one of you who contributed to the annual fund this year. To use the theme of tonight's talk, I will tell you that it is no secret that only 27% of membership fees cover our operating expenses. So in order to offer, you know, excellent informative programs like tonight, we really do require your help, and it is very much appreciated. So thank you to all of you. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Frederick A.O. Schwartz, Jr. Mr. Schwartz has had a long and incredibly distinguished career, so you'll forgive me if I've had to edit this down a bit. After graduating from Harvard Law School and becoming a partner at Kravis, Swain & Moore, he was named chief counsel to the Senate Select Committee to study governmental activities with respect to intelligence activities, more commonly referred to as the Church Commission. The Church Committee, excuse me. He went on to chair the commission that revised New York City's charter and the New York City Campaign Finance Board. He is currently chief counsel of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law, where he testifies frequently before Congress, and he's been awarded the New York State Bar Association's Gold Medal for Distinguished Service in the Law, as well as the Rittenhouse Courage Prize in recognition of his lifelong commitment to strengthening democracy and the rule of law. Mr. Schwartz has written three books, and his latest, which you'll be hearing about tonight, Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy, illuminates one central question. How much secrecy does good governance require? I personally found this book extraordinary. I highly recommend every single one of you reading it. The cases he uses, lessons from the Iran-Contra affair, the Cuban Missile Crisis, 9/11, and other stories to illustrate how secrecy undermines the ability of ordinary Americans to make informed choices required and assumed in a democratic society. Of this book, the Journal Foreign Affairs has written, Mr. Schwartz has produced a thoughtful, authoritative account of the troubling consequences of excessive secrecy, and Publishers Weekly has declared that this book will prove a necessary addition to ongoing policy debates. Please join me in welcoming Frederick Schwartz.
So thank you very much. It's great to be in this beautiful space and have a chance to talk with all of you. And I hope that after I do some opening remarks that we'll get a lot of questions, which is more fun for me and probably for you. So let me start with when I first began to think about secrecy, which was when I was lucky enough at age 39 to be named chief counsel to the Church Committee. But to confess, what I really thought about them were secrets and not secrecy. And I saw my job as chief counsel to get the information from the White House and the CIA and the FBI and NSA and put that to the senators and put that to the public so we could get reform. We had an argument in the Church Committee about whether the right way to approach our work was to have a panel of, and this is actually the words that we use, wise men come and tell us what was wrong with the intelligence community and what would be the good ideas of how to fix it. And I argued, no, that's not the way to do it. We have to have real facts that affect and offend real people if we have any chance of getting reform. But as my confession, I didn't think hard about secrecy as opposed to secrets. And then a few years ago, actually it took me 5 years to write and research and finish up and edit and get the book out, I thought that it would be worth looking at the subject of secrecy a little deeper. I mean, in the broadest sense, there are one big problem, there's too much secrecy, but one necessary understanding is that some secrecy is appropriate. So this book tries to tell stories which show abuses of secrecy, but also make arguments that some secrecy is legitimate. How to draw that line is not always easy, but is absolutely necessary to do. The parallel investigation that the House undertook at the same time as the Church Committee was unfortunately a total failure, because they did not understand that there were legitimate secrets, and as a result, the Ford administration was able to undermine them and deride them, and ultimately they fizzled out, not doing what they could have done. So the book starts with an introduction that tries to say why, you know, in the most important sense, why is this about democracy in the dark, and what does it mean to talk about the seduction of government secrecy, and develop the themes of the book. And then chapter one starts in the Garden of Eden. Chapter one takes all of 12 pages to go from the Garden of Eden to the American Revolution. But the Garden of Eden point is sort of important, because what happened there was God expelled Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden because they dared to seek knowledge. And then later in Genesis, God destroyed the Babel, the Tower of Babel, because again, that was being built by people to try to acquire knowledge. And the lesson I say we should learn, and I hope this is not a sacrilegious or profane point to make, I don't think it is, but maybe it is, but the lesson I say that you can learn from that is throughout human history, powerful people have tried to limit the access of ordinary people to information. And that's a theme through all of our history. It's a theme in world history and American history. Chapter one, in this dramatic 12 gallop through history, finishes in Great Britain at the time of the French Revolution, when a man called Cooper, who eventually emigrated to the United States and was one of the people caught up in the Sedition Act and thrown in jail for criticizing President John Adams. But Cooper had gone to France along with Watt's son, and they came back, and Cooper praised the French Revolution. He was castigated, pilloried, derided in Parliament. And then in response to that derision, Cooper published a pamphlet defending his defense of the French Revolution. So the British Attorney General wrote a letter to Cooper saying, well, Mr. Cooper, that pamphlet of yours was published very nicely and beautifully bound and was quite expensive. But I've heard rumors that you're planning to write another pamphlet that will be cheap and available to ordinary people. And if you do that, I'm going to prosecute you for violating the secrecy of Parliament. So that is another theme, so the chapter one finishes with another theme that runs through the book, which is elitism. And some information, it can go to the elite, but it can't possibly, it should not go to ordinary people. In the chapter on the Supreme Court, I try to analogize the Supreme Court's barring of television from their arguments to the same attitude as the British Attorney General. And I think the argument works, but you'd have to read the book to decide if you agree with that. So the rest of the book just runs the major themes and tries to illustrate the arguments with lots of stories from history. And the themes, again, are too much secrecy for too long. And both of those are very important. And in a way, the for too long is a harder problem to get at than the too much. But it's too much for too long. Second, that there is some necessary secrecy, and that's been true from the beginning. Talking about the beginning for a minute again, our Senate, the U.S. Senate, like the British Parliament, for the first 6 or 7 years of American history, nobody could come and visit the Senate and see what was going on. No reporters, no members of the House, nobody in the public. And after 6 or 7 years, there was a sort of a revolution principally generated by journalists that led to the Senate changing its rule, and so the Senate became open. But we started out with some inheritances from the British of too much secrecy. And the third theme is that while secrecy is often or sometimes necessary, it's too often used to hide illegality or embarrassment. Now, contrary to conventional wisdom, however, there are many reasons for secrecy, for excessive secrecy, that have nothing to do with hiding illegality or embarrassment. What are some examples of that? One is the, well, let me make another point first. The secrecy spawns more secrecy. And this is very clear. Right now, every year, 100 million new documents are stamped secret. Now, let's assume you are a smart person in the Defense Department, and you have some important idea. There is no chance that your document is going to get written, get read, unless it's stamped at least top secret. And the heads of the CIA, major military people, Defense Department chiefs have all said, it's true, we don't have the time, and we won't be reading things that aren't top secret. So 100 million documents each year being stamped is top secret. Do you think when you're that young person trying to get your great idea read by the people for whom you work, that you're not gonna stamp it top secret? So you are. So secrecy spawns more secrecy. Now, another thing that's contrary to conventional wisdom is that classification is not the only problem. It's classification that we think about when we think about secrecy, but some of the most important acts in this country, practices in this country that overuse secrecy and injure the country had nothing to do with classification. So let me just give two or three examples. One is that starting with George Washington and running for 180 years until Richard Nixon, every president believed that they owned the documents that had been written by them, or even more than that, had been written during their administration. And George Washington was the first to do that, and he took, when he left office, all his documents. They had interesting results. I guess it was John Marshall himself, wrote a biography of George Washington, and the story is that he found that many of the documents, when they were stored in some basement, had been eaten by rats. So you lost the one consequence of this practice that presidents owned their documents and could take them, was just that they would get lost. Or in Washington's case and in some others, they were clipped up so that little excerpts could be sold because they were valuable. If you could get something written by the Holy Father, it would be a great thing. And then there were more perverse handling of documents. Presidents who destroyed documents because they didn't want history to learn what had happened. There were people, even the presidents or the president's families, that were careful about keeping the documents, kept them secret for far, far too long. Like the Adams family had a great library in which they carefully put all of the documents of John Adams and John Quincy Adams. But the rule was, I think it was 120 years after the death of the first John Adams, before the public could get access to those documents. Or Abraham Lincoln, whose son, the one who was a lawyer from Harvard Law School, had custody of the documents, and they were not made available until it was something like 90 years after Lincoln's assassination. So this was a practice, perhaps understandable in the early years, because in those years, maybe the president actually handwrote the documents. There weren't that many. There weren't copying machines. So maybe it was not something that was weird in the beginning, but it was something that lasted far too long and only ended because of Nixon and the Watergate scandal. Although Nixon, then when he had to surrender his documents, was paid something like $35 million for surrendering them. When they, you know, they shouldn't have been owned by the presidents in any sense. They were done, paid for by the public and done for the public, and they should have been available to the public. Another example of much less long-lasting of secrecy had nothing to do with classification was the rule that Dick Cheney and George H.W. Bush put into effect, that no photographs could be taken of the soldiers' coffins that came back to Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. And that lasted until Barack Obama and Secretary Gates said, well, we shouldn't bar photographers. It should be up to the families to decide whether the coffins can be photographed or not. And then a third form of secrecy that again has nothing to do with classification is the practice of various White Houses, most White Houses, but some more than others, of holding meetings in the White House in which only yay-sayers are invited to discuss difficult questions. Now, Cheney is an interesting person in that as well, because I have a whole chapter that's called J. Edgar Hoover and Dick Cheney. And just a word on J. Edgar Hoover. When we did our work, most people thought the most important part of it was about the CIA, and certainly a lot of what we did about the CIA was extremely interesting and extremely troubling. But I thought the FBI discoveries were our most important, and that the harm that Hoover and the FBI did was greater than the CIA. And the way I perhaps oversimplified that at the time and in the book as well is the CIA, their acts of inappropriate acts injured our reputation overseas, whereas Hoover's FBI tried to destroy our democracy at home. And between those two, I think you have to say the greater danger was from the FBI than from the CIA. But anyway, Cheney on White House meetings is a very interesting evolution. When he was the chief of staff of for Gerald Ford, being the youngest person ever to have that job, just as J. Edgar Hoover, who served for 48 years, was in his 20s when he got the job of head of the FBI. But Cheney, when he was Gerald Ford's chief of staff, said, the single most important thing you can do as chief of staff is to be sure the president hears both sides of every issue before making a difficult decision. Fast forward to Cheney in the White House, and you could say, particularly in Bush's first term, that Cheney's mantra was, the most important thing is that the president hear from me. And certainly, they did not want to have people who would be on the other side of where they thought they wanted to come out at the meetings. And I try in the book to psychoanalyze Cheney a little bit, and kind of end up throwing up my hands saying you can't be sure why he changed, except it might have had something to do with personal power, but that would be too cynical perhaps to say. So the book proceeds after the introduction and that gallop through history to a chapter on 9/11, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the use of the atomic bomb. And I use each of those to make a point which is, in a sense, the complexity of secrecy issues. On 9/11, the subject I talk about is the number of very explicit warnings that the Bush White House got from the CIA about the likelihood that Al-Qaeda was going to have a far, 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 far more dangerous attack than anything that had ever been done before. And there were numerous documents that the Bush White House, the Bush-Cheney White House, got from the CIA warning about Al-Qaeda and the likelihood that it was going to do something extremely dangerous. Now those warnings, an interesting fact, under Clinton, those warnings which were in something called the Presidential Daily Brief, went to something like 22 people. Under Bush, they went to something like 7 or 8 people, so it was that's not necessarily, you can't know whether that's good or bad. But the point I make is that had the Bush administration revealed those warnings, I think it is absolutely certain that 9/11 would have been prevented, particularly because it would have let the FBI agents who were already suspicious of people taking flying lessons who, you know, didn't care about learning how to land or take off, and properly suspicious, but were frustrated and prevented from arresting people in that circumstance or getting the emails and the computers of people in that circumstance. And I think had the administration put out the fact that we have gotten these warnings, I think 9/11 would have been prevented. Now, that doesn't mean they were crazy not to do it. You certainly ought to be very careful about when you would describe information like that about warnings. And I don't think one can or should blame the Bush administration for not doing that. But I think the comment you can make fairly is that the secrecy regime is one where people, once it's stamped secret, they sort of stop thinking about whether it should continue to be secret. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis, the key thing is that that's a story of great heroism and toughness by Jack Kennedy. But the unknown part of the story was that agreement with the Russians for the Russians to pull their missiles out, their atomic missiles out of Cuba, is facilitated by Robert Kennedy going to the talk to the Soviet ambassador in Washington and saying, if you pull your missiles out of Cuba, we will, within 6 months, pull our missiles out of Turkey, which is just like Cuba, which is 90 miles off our shore. Turkey is 1 mile off the border of Russia. And so Bobby Kennedy said, we will pull our missiles out of Turkey if you take yours out of Cuba. But the condition is you can't tell anyone that we've made that deal with you. So the Cuban Missile Crisis was solved. The articles, particularly in the Atlantic, a very powerful article which praises John Kennedy's toughness, and he was strong and tough, but it left out this particular fact. Now, again, there was a legitimate reason for not making that understanding public at the time, because the Turks and others who depended on the U.S. might have said, oh, well, you know, if ever the United States is threatened, our interests will be downplayed. So there may have been a legitimate diplomatic reason for keeping that secret at the time. There was no justification for keeping that secret. See, the Cuban Missile Crisis was 62, and it's not till the 90s that it comes out that Bobby Kennedy had made that particular deal. And it's an example of long-lasting secrecy, which ultimately has to be for political reasons, helping either the political future in the short term before Bobby Kennedy's also killed, or helping the reputations of the Kennedys for the longer term. So does it make any difference? I think you can make the case, and Bob Caro, who I believe does all his work here in the library, I'd be interested to see how he handles this in his next volume, which we're all looking forward to. But I think you can make the case that it adversely affected LBJ in whether he was willing to negotiate, because LBJ had been on the commission that JFK had formed to deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis. But of that commission, only the two Kennedy brothers and 7 members knew of the deal with the Soviets, and LBJ and the military and others like Douglas Dillon, who were on the XCOM, were not told about it. And I do think Johnson was disinclined to make deals, or was inclined to always look tough, 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 because the public lesson of the missile crisis had been that Kennedy won by being tough, 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 and not that he also made a mutually useful deal. And then the atomic bomb, I think, is the most interesting of the 3 case studies. On May 31st of 1945, a group of people, including the president of Harvard and the president of MIT and the head of the Department of War, Mr. Stimson, and 4 or 5 others, made the decision to drop the first atomic bomb on a crowded city. Now, between May 31st and the bomb being dropped on Hiroshima, by the way, I say in the book that I don't, in the book, purport to deal with should we have used the bomb or not, and, you know, there are arguments on both sides, but I simply am agnostic on that in the book. But between May 31st and when the bomb was actually dropped on August 6th or August 8th in Hiroshima, the 2 facts had changed. One, the atomic bomb was far, far more powerful than even the best scientists had predicted it was going to be. And we learned that from the explosion that was in New Mexico at Trinity. It was I guess codenamed Trinity, and it was somewhere in New Mexico. We learned that the atomic bomb was far, far more powerful than we had thought. And the second was that by August, we knew we had more bombs available. So the thesis I say, well, why didn't they think about whether they should start by dropping the bomb on a crowded city and rethink that and decide, well, why don't we start by dropping the bomb on a naval base, Japanese naval base in Japan, and see if that leads to movement towards surrender. And it might or it might not have. But the point about secrecy that I make is that when you've announced a decision, you're going to benefit enormously from public comment on, you know, is it wise? Was it wise? Is it still wise? Should you change it? Now, this decision, that we had the bomb, that we were going to use it, and when we were going to use it, leaving out whether we should ever have used the bomb at all, but being agnostic on that, that was all appropriately secret. But the point I make in the book is that where you have the public knows you're doing something, you're going to get plenty of useful advice. But if the public doesn't know you're going to do something, you should remember yourself to re-examine your decision as the facts go on. And so that, in other words, if you know you have an appropriate secret, you should remember to keep thinking about the subject and not just say, oh, we've made the decision, and forget about it. Of course, as things turned out, some of the facts are really quite embarrassing for our country. The decision on where to drop the bomb was left in the hands of the guy who built the bomb, General Groves, which, if you think about it, is a little strange that you would have, he was a military person, an engineer, but to have the person who built the bomb decide where to use it already sounds a little funny to me. And it was a little funny, because what did Groves decide about Hiroshima? Hiroshima had been justified as the target because there were some industrial facilities in it, and so you were not only trying to kill civilians, but you were trying to get rid of the industrial facilities. Now, it was not an important target because they had to struggle to find targets that the U.S. Air Force hadn't already destroyed in Japan. And Hiroshima, the Air Force had left alone, so it by definition was not an enormously important target, except it had a lot of civilians. So Groves said, well, as to where we actually put the bomb in Hiroshima, I want it to be put right smack in the center of the city, because that will be the best experiment for us to see how widespread the destructive power of the bomb is. The consequence of that was the 100,000 people who were killed at the time and the more who were killed later, and those industrial facilities were not destroyed because they were on the outskirts of the city. Now, that's probably a point more about the atomic bomb than about secrecy. The main point about secrecy and the atomic bomb is they stopped thinking, and they should have been thinking even harder because they knew they weren't getting comments from the outside. So I want to talk about the democracy title a little bit, and then give you why I think there are some reasons for hope for change, and then you guys have a lot of questions. So One is the Declaration of Independence, and the other is the Gettysburg Address. And each of them contain an argument that is worried about, that lays the groundwork for the title Democracy in the Dark. In the Declaration, Jefferson says, a just government derives its just powers from the consent of the government. A government from the consent of its people. A government derives its just powers from the consent of the people. Well, how can the people consent if the people are uninformed? So there's a basic theme of the argument, the watch out for democracy being kept in the dark in the Declaration. And same in the Gettysburg Address, where Lincoln has the plea that we shall not permit government of the people, by the people, and for the people to perish from the face of the earth. And to have government by the people, again, requires that the people should have as much information as they can, and that we should work as hard as we can to limit the number of documents, the number of ideas that are kept secret, and we should limit as much as we can the length of time that things are kept secret. We talk about the missile crisis. There still, or there were as of 3 years ago, I haven't checked recently, but documents about the Cuban Missile Crisis that are still kept secret by the CIA. 1962, and they still should be secret, and we should learn from the history. That can't be right, and it, there is. But it's hard to get rid of the overhang. I use the metaphor of Sisyphus in the book, that his problem, that he tried to push it up the mountain and then came down the head and push it up again. Well, the problem of documents, the mounds and mountains of documents, is worse than Sisyphus, because you push it up, it comes, you roll down, and then the mountain's higher the next time. And they are constantly getting higher. I mean, President Obama and President Clinton and others have cut back somewhat on the overhang, but the number of new things, that 100 million every year, keep growing. Now, to some extent, those figures can be misleading, because in the electronic age, there are so many more copies of things. So it has, under Obama, and by the way, I could talk about Obama more, but his record is good on some things and poor on others, but he has cut back, or during his term, what's called original classification has been reduced, but the number of documents classified has grown up enormously because of the electronic world, and the number of documents are so vastly increased. Now, let me just get a drink of water here. I have two reasons for guarded optimism about the future of the secrecy issue. One is, it's not a partisan issue. That is most unusual for this day and age. But after the Snowden revelations, the first action was in the House, and they came within about 10 votes of cutting back on the NSA's collection of what's called metadata, so that for every single one of us, they had information on all the calls we've made. And the bill, which came within 10 votes of passing in the House, was sponsored by a man called Justin Amash, who is a Tea Party, very young representative. And the co-sponsor was a Republican Tea Party, very conservative. And the co-sponsor was John Conyers, Democratic congressman, longtime Democratic congressman from Detroit, very liberal guy. So there you're having the two polar opposites coming together on this issue. And then when the bill ultimately passed in 14, I guess the spring of 14, could have been in 15, but in the Senate, the two sponsors are Republican Senator Mike Lee, very conservative from Utah, and Democratic Senator Pat Leahy, liberal senator from Vermont. And the bill passed with support on both sides of the aisle. Now, you know, there'll always be ups and downs when you have a new terror attack. The people generally say, well, I don't want to touch the issue of too much secrecy now, but it's important that it's a nonpartisan issue. The other reason why I have some optimism rests in the thinking of the most intelligent people in the CIA and the NSA, who have begun to conclude that secrecy actually gets, excessive secrecy gets in the way of their mission. And what do they see as their main mission? That the leaders of this country get revealing and important information just as quickly as possible. And these smart people in the CIA and the NSA are beginning to say, well, when you have this huge incrustation of secrecy, first place, it's never going to last as long as it used to, because there are so many forces, which we could talk about, that make it harder for a lot of secrets to last as long as they used to. But they're saying, forget about how long they last. The presence of this, the overhang of this huge body of secrets, gets in the way of our main mission, which is to try to get to the leaders of the country the key information just as quickly as possible. So I think there will be continuing reform. The hardest thing is getting rid of the overhang of the stuff that's been around for years and years and years. Because now think that you're the head of the Defense Department, and you have millions and millions of documents that are stamped secret, and what are you going to do? Are you going to take thousands of people and put them at work looking at those documents and saying, well, this one, let it go, let it go, let it go. Well, this one we got to be careful with, and in this one there are five words that we have to be careful with. Very time-consuming work, and work where you as a bureaucrat now are going to be saying, wow, where is the upside for me in doing this? Because one mistake out of 10,000 choices and I'm in big trouble. So the forces of inertia are very strong in making it hard to address the enormous volume of material. So anyway, that's enough of my talking, and I hope you all have a lot of questions. See themselves vet it to be sure it's not going to cause harm. So, and another thing about Snowden, I've been on a couple of events where I was in person and he was up there on the screen. So I've seen him almost as like, you know, talking to him. And he's a very normal person. A lot of whistleblowers are admirable, but off. They're still admirable, but they're off. But he's not off at all. So I think he ought to be allowed to come back to the United States. Whether it's a pure pardon or something where he does some recompense, whatever it is, and I'm sure he, by the way, would be perfectly happy to, if he could come back to this country to do something that recognizes he did break the law, even though it was for good motives and it was helpful.
His guardian friends do want him.
Say that again?
The Guardian newspaper.
Yeah.
His friends who work with him. And Citizen Four is a wonderful film.
Yeah, that's a wonderful film.
Wonderful. But they feel that he would expect to be asked to do recompense, what he has done.
And the idea that he should be in Russia is just horrible. I've heard he would like to go to Iceland before coming back here, but that is concerned that there'd be an extradition and that maybe he would not be safe there. In the long run, he's going to be recognized as having done a lot of good. Now, there are people who argue that on some of his disclosures about overseas stuff, that it isn't as clearly non-harmful. I think there is an answer to that, and they point to some examples, but most of those examples, perhaps all of them, are ones where the information had come out otherwise, so he wasn't the sole source. He did try to do good for the country, and he did help the country.
Thank you.
Carl.
Yeah, Mr. First, thanks for a really interesting talk. But I want to throw, using your own analysis, a historical question. When the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia, and maybe you deal with this in your book, but the first decision was to keep it confidential. And then Madison kept the papers for, I think, 30 or 40 years until his death.
51 years. Well, let me start with Madison and then deal with the Constitutional Convention. There was no, Madison was a brilliant person, and his notes are the most valuable, not the only source of what actually happened during the Constitutional Convention. And he always said he was going to keep them for 50 years, and there was no justification for that. They don't get into the public domain until 50 or 51 years later, and every single other delegate to the convention had died. So think of, you write down things and you have, it's this thick, the Madison's notes, and you're not going to get it all right by definition. So it's here, for one thing, leave out it being harmful to history. You're being unfair to your colleagues not to give them a shot at saying, that's not what my argument was. So much as I admire Madison, I thought that was a terrible mistake. On the convention itself, it was secret. George Washington has a dramatic statement about someone having left a copy of the notes on the floor, and he slams it down on the table and says, "Let whoever did that come and pick it up," and of course no one came to pick it up. And they were terrified of George Washington. But the argument that anything flows from that is very weak, because what the convention
convention had done, A, as soon as they were finished, was printed. And more important than that, the words from the convention were, as both Madison and a guy called Wilson, who was, I think, from Pennsylvania and a very thoughtful person, they were just words on a piece of paper and meant nothing until the state conventions had ratified, and those state conventions were all completely open. So it is an argument that I think if one is arguing against excessive secrecy, one has to address, but I think it's a weak argument in light of the facts, particularly the complete open discussion of the Constitution at the state conventions before it went into effect.
It also kind of undermines the original intention part, if you're not clear what the original intention was.
Yeah, I mean, that's an argument for getting Madison's stuff out earlier, and whose intention really matters, the people who drafted the Constitution or the people who addressed it in the state ratifying conventions, where we had the Federalist Papers were direct here, written anonymously by Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay, but they're regarded as a great definitive description of what the Constitution means. They're certainly well written. I'm not sure that all of it, some of it, like a couple of Hamilton's ones, are very good and actually argue points different than the ones he'd taken at the convention itself. But the Federalist Papers are an example of an open discussion, and the conventions themselves were really open and hotly contested.
I read a book last year that talked about they were mostly anti-war activists who broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and discovered Hotel Pro, which then was one of the things that led to the church committee. My question is, why did it take so long for those people, where the church committee was basically finding that, yes, the things they were concerned about in the family needed to be aired, why did it take so long for most of them to go public? My second question is about corporate secrecy and whether you see that as a growing concern, adding a whole layer of complexity to people's need for information or even a threat to the bondage.
So on the Media Pennsylvania, there's a very good film about that break-in called 1971. And it was a break-in in 1971. If you sit through that film for an hour and a half, you'll see me at 39 or 40 talking to senators about COINTELPRO. And I loved having my grandchildren see that film.
When did that come out?
It came out maybe in April of 2014. And it's by a woman called Hamilton, I think her name is, and it's called 1971, and it's a superb documentary. So why did they not come forward? Well, for the first period of time, they knew if they came forward, they would be indicted, and Hoover would have really said what a horrible thing this was and crumbling our nation and so forth. Then after that, I don't know why it was, the author knew two of the break-in people, but she was the person who broke the story in the Washington Post. Interesting sideline. After they stole those documents that just had the word COINTELPRO in it, and so it didn't get much attention at the beginning, and there were other worse documents, like Hoover saying to all FBI agents, I want all students in the country to think that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. But anyway, Betty Metzger was the reporter at the Washington Post, and she broke the story. her book is called The Burglars, and it's also it's a great story. But the burglars sent copies to the New York Times and to the LA Times, as well as the Washington Post. And in one of those cases, the FBI had an agent in the mailroom and swiped it so it didn't get to the appropriate person. And in the other case, and I don't remember which, whether it was the New York Times or the LA Times, one of them just returned the papers to the FBI and didn't run the story. And it was very controversial at the Washington Post about whether to run it, and Ben Bradley pushed hard for it, and Catherine Graham ultimately agrees over the advice of her lawyers, who said don't do it. And her lawyers were from my firm, but not me. So they courageously did, and it was a very important story. So why did they, after the statute of limitations had run, not say, oh, we were the ones? I don't know. They may have still been afraid of what would happen to them. But it comes out, the author, Betty Metzger, who had broken the story in the Washington Post and had no idea that two of her friends from Philadelphia were part of the burglary, and so they're there, and one of the husband or wife says to the daughter, she broke the story of our burglary, and so she says, wow, will you let me publish that? So COINTELPRO was a horrible program that J. Edgar Hoover devised, starting with the U.S. Communist Party, for whom maybe one's heart doesn't bleed, but the tactic, and then going to the Socialist Workers Party, and then the, what they called the Black Nationalist Hate Groups, and Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference was defined as a Black Nationalist Hate Group, and then going to the New Left, and the Hoover instructed the agents not to acquire intelligence, but to harass and destroy the people in these various groups. And the one of the most telling documents was involved the gangs in Chicago, one being the Blackstone Rangers, and the other being the Black Panthers. And we discovered a document where the FBI agent in Chicago recommends a harassment campaign, a COINTELPRO campaign, in which he said, the head of the Blackstone Rangers is known to be extremely violent and have a very trigger-ready anger. And let's send a letter to him, a forged letter, in which we say that the Black Panthers are planning to do something horrible to the head of the Blackstone Rangers. And the theory is that this will lead the Blackstone Ranger guy to shoot and kill someone in the Black Panthers. Also in the COINTELPRO was the horrible decision by the FBI to, first they obtained permission to bug the hotel rooms of Martin Luther King, and they got stuff that was, you know, personal, and they put together a tape from the overhearing of stuff going on in King's hotel rooms and send it to him, and it's clear from the evidence they sent it to him with the hope that it would lead Martin Luther King to commit suicide. And the letter was concealed, it wasn't, you know, they hoped it wouldn't be traced to the FBI. COINTELPRO was pretty terrible. I'll tell you a little story about, I mean, we had a great Senate committee, 11 people. Mike Mansfield, who was the head of the, who was majority leader of the Senate, said he wanted the church committee to be 6 Democrats and 5 Republicans, when the normal committee at that time would have been 7 Democrats and 4 Republicans. And second, he wanted the leading Republican, who was John Tower from Texas, to be the number 2, the vice chairman, instead of what the normal thing is, the leader of the opposition is called the leading member or something. It's a meaningless title, but John Tower was actually our vice chairman. And it was a really nonpartisan committee that never once had a single vote that was on partisan lines. That didn't mean we didn't have differences. For example, the revelations about the NSA, which I can discuss what they were, but it was a very close vote on whether we should reveal those. That was a 6-5 vote, but it wasn't a partisan difference. But Barry Goldwater, who I thought, I did not know a single senator when I was asked to do this job. And I assumed Barry Goldwater would be sort of a person on the side of privacy and therefore worried about excess. And he was the one disappointment on the committee. And I tell this story in the author's note at the end of the book. But I had originally, we'd agreed that we'd have a limited number of subjects to investigate, because if we did everything, we would end up doing nothing. So we had to pick like 15, 20 subjects to really dig down on. And one of them was the FBI's treatment of Martin Luther King. And when I went down the list of proposed things to do, they all just sailed through the committee, except Barry Goldwater objected to investigating the FBI's treatment of Martin Luther King. And Senator Church said, why? And Barry Goldwater said, well, you remember when he was killed, they rioted, and we don't want them to riot again, so let's lay off that subject. So Senator Church and the rest of the committee said, no, we should do it. So then, 6-8 months later, before we're about to have our public hearings on the FBI, I tell the committee in executive session what those hearings are going to involve and how disturbing some of the facts were. And I mention the FBI making this composite tape and sending it to the King family and hoping that Martin Luther King would commit suicide. And I said, neither I nor any other member of the staff, nor have I let any other member of the staff listen to the tape, because it seemed to me that would just further be compounding the insult to the privacy of the King family. So Goldwater, who had said we shouldn't investigate this in the first place, he said, well, I think Fritz is, I remember his words exactly, I think Fritz is wrong on this. We should take that tape and play it on national television.
Oh,
so that was pretty bad. So you had a second question, and I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, my second question was about, do you think that things have changed in complexity and that the threat to democracy has changed with the way that there have been, the way there's corporate secrecy with regard to things that people are beginning to feel are affecting their health, for example?
Yeah.
And it seems like the courts are constantly finding in favor of the corporations. And then perhaps, too, the way the military started using, private contractors and things, it seems like there's a line that's becoming increasingly blurred between.
Yeah, I don't think I'm an expert on, at least in this book, on the treatment of corporations. Courts are interesting. Sometimes they're good, but they're terrified when a national security case comes in front of them, and it does in two ways. One, in Freedom of Information Act cases where the government may object to something on national security grounds, and two, where the government uses something called the state secrets doctrine to try to get cases dismissed, and because the evidence would reveal a state secret. And that's been carried way too far. I'm going to come back to the courts, but that doctrine has been carried way too far. And in examples where we tortured people who have been found to be innocent, and where foreign governments have released all the facts, and there's one of those cases involving a Syrian who was Canadian also, and the Canadian government released all the facts and paid him money for the way he was mistreated by the United States. And another one involving a person who was picked up because his Arabic name was very similar to a terror suspect, and he was tortured and mistreated, and that was found by judges in Switzerland to have been the case, and all the facts are public. Nonetheless, the government, and here's the area where I fault Obama on these issues, his Justice Department has consistently tried to dismiss those cases on state secrets grounds. Now, the courts, just to get back to the courts, they're terrified of being wrong, and therefore they go very far, mostly, usually, there are exceptions, but in upholding the government's position on FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. And I show how in Israel, where they have our security problems and worse, but their courts have been pretty good at not automatically accepting the government's claims for denial of what the Freedom of Information Act request or the equivalent of a state secrets proposal.
Maybe one more question.
Question about technology. What are your thoughts about the ongoing debate about I gather law enforcement is concerned about the fact that a lot of the technology we use today, when we send emails and messages or whatever, that law enforcement is saying, well, you know, we need to investigate a potential terrorist or someone going against the state. We need a back door, and the technology companies are resisting that. So do you have any thoughts on, what is your position on that, and where is this debate going? Do you have any answers?
Well, I don't cover that in the book. It has erupted more since I finished the book. And my office, the Brennan Center, has a wing that focuses on what we call liberty and national security. And they've written, I think, powerfully arguing that if you have a back door that the U.S. government can get in, then the Chinese government and the Russian government, by the way, the Chinese have done incredible amounts of espionage, and there's a story from one of the smartest ex-NSA, CSCI people in here, how the number of documents they've gotten from the Defense Department would take trucks like from here to Boston to get out. I mean, they've done a whole lot, and we should worry about it. So I'm not sure how I come out on that backdoor question. I mean, I understand why the government is frustrated if they can't get at it, and also I think the technology companies, while they don't want to censor messages, if you have jihadist messages coming over, I mean, it would be nice if the government and Silicon Valley could do something together on that. But on the backdoor question, I think there is a problem. No, it eventually was revealed by some of the people who knew it, like Ted Sorensen, who admitted that he had helped conceal it, and that he actually falsified Bobby Kennedy's memoir, the diary, when he posthumously helped publish something. And so it came out from the people who knew it. For some reason, the Russians never came out with the information. They're beautiful.